I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. Water permeates all things. It's the backbone ingredient to the food we eat, the clothes we wear, and the sanitation we've come to rely on. Even so, as we go about our daily lives, most of us don't think much about it. Imagine for a moment that access to clean, usable water was in doubt, subject to rationing, or only available to those who could afford it. What if instead of turning on the tap, you had to carve out hours a day to go in search of water in order to cook, clean, and survive? Believe it or not, that's what billions of people in poor and parched places do every day. And according to my guest Stanley Samuel, it's high time to reevaluate the importance and the value we place on this prized commodity. Through his company, Ecosoft, Samuel has set out to address both the overconsumption and underconsumption problems associated with water. Depending on the location and the circumstances, he and his colleagues use a combination of for-profit and not-for-profit approaches to drive water-conscious behavior. I caught up with Stanley at the Industrial Park offices of Ecosoft. I started by asking about his upbringing and why water conservation has become such a central concern.
I was born in a middle-class family of basically teachers, and this was in central India, in a state called Madhya Pradesh. And when I look back at my childhood, what stands out is, of course, the phenomenal support from my parents in terms of the good education. But I also had to wake up every morning at 4 a.m. to fill water as a young boy before going to school. And it's just that over the years, the walk became longer. The wait at the source became longer as well, because more and more people were fighting for the same pool of water. And we didn't have any pipe water systems at that point in time. And this whole experience and tryst with water actually continued in my life. And there was a strange connection, because the more I ran away from water, the more I ran into it as a problem through the last 35 years of my life. So going to school, coming back again, getting involved to fill water. And during summer camps, my parents or my grandmother, who influenced me a lot, actually sent me out for building rainwater harvesting systems, helping clean the local lakes and rivers, etc. So the baptism or induction into water as a problem was at a very early stage.
These were projects in order to try to maintain the water system as it was?
Those days, the water systems and the ones that our ancestors had built or curated or nurtured were absolutely precious, because they were the only source of surface water available to anybody.
So these were community projects in order to sustain the very water that you lived on?
For agriculture, for animal husbandry, for individual survival, if you like, and for community survival. Mm. So they were very significant. And most of my summers, I spent working with the community on these projects. I did about, I think, in the 10 years of schooling, almost about 8 projects.
So you lived this. This is something that was just in your DNA. I mean, the importance and the security that comes with water and freshwater supply was tantamount to your family's existence and ability to kind of thrive.
Absolutely. And when I left my little hometown and came to a city like New Delhi, I did not realize that, again, I would be getting up at 4 a.m. to steal water from the neighbor's tank, because...
Even in New Delhi,
on the outskirts of the city, in a place called Noida, which is now Uttar Pradesh, because we were never home and power was always, I would say, there would be blackouts. Mm. And if you're not home and the power is there, you cannot pump water to the third and fifth story. Mm. So we would be siphoning water from the neighbor's tank, if you like.
And of course, in India today, the cities do have plumbing systems and there's a lot of water, but many communities still in and around big cities live this way, looking for water wherever they can find it.
Absolutely. So globally, the municipal services have not been able to keep pace with the rapid urbanization and development. Mm. They've always been in catch-up mode. So in a country like India, the footprint is as low as 40%. So 60% of the population is still not served by, you know, private connections. They still have to go to a community tap. And the people who have access to direct tap water is 20-30%. Of course, it's improving. But what's scary is that it is expected that almost 60-70% of the world's population is going to be living in city-like conditions. Yeah. And this 150-200-year-old system of centralized, utility-driven services is certainly very, very difficult to keep up.
And in the meantime, you've got aquifers which are declining, water tables are falling, demands on water growing, you've got desalination issues. So cities are hard-pressed to figure out ways of managing water for their entire population.
Absolutely. And the reality today is that 2.5 billion people do not have access to safe drinking water. The other 2.5 billion people who have some access don't trust the quality of water. And the other 2.5 billion people are worried about the impact the other 5 billion will have on their water sources thanks to climate change.
Right. So everybody should be thinking about water if they're not.
Water poverty, Stephen, is a global phenomenon.
Right.
It's affecting the world, whether you're a rich nation, poor nation, first world, third world. I can tell you, sitting in Singapore, we import almost 250 million gallons of our water demand every day from neighboring Malaysia.
What percentage of that is the total of the total water available?
Almost 40% of the intake. So of course, Singapore has got it right because we built the infrastructure, and the vision and blueprint for this nation was a lot to do with water security. So the government has spent for the last 40, 50 years to become the hydro hub of the world, to be known for best practices. But that has happened through investments, through a vision and a commitment that we have to be water secure before 2061, when the kind of treaty expires.
So one of the most sophisticated, wealthy cities in the world, working for 50 years and still only maybe half of the water supply can they produce and manage locally.
Absolutely. And that is supported by what we call the three other national taps. So we have four national taps. One is rain. The other is reclaiming used water, which in other parts of the world is called sewage, and desalination to complement the whole thing.
So if you have a country, a city state like Singapore, you know, albeit with a population of 5.5-6 million people, and then you basically juxtapose that to a place like India with hundreds of millions of people with this mass urbanization, and then you look at the other cities in other parts of developing world in Africa, Southeast Asia, China, elsewhere, the size and dimension of the challenge is almost overwhelming, isn't it?
It is indeed, and because if you look at the total population that India has compared to the rest of the globe, and also the total amount of fresh water reserves, is absolutely skewed to the extent that water stress is extremely high. One, because of the ground and surface waters have got depleted or contaminated. The groundwater aquifers are depleting at an alarming rate. And unfortunately, in a large part of the world, our main source of water is ground and surface water bodies. And in most countries, almost all of the untreated sewage goes back to the same sources. So it's almost like a closed loop system, but with a downward spiral. And I remember when I was a small boy, my grandmother used to basically, we used to drink water straight from source. Then she started straining it with a muslin cloth. And then she started adding alum just to make sure the deposit settled down. And then we started boiling it. And now you have reverse osmosis and all kinds of technologies into people's kitchens and homes. It's not sustainable. In India, for example, the things are improving, but still almost about 70% of the untreated sewage goes back to sources.
Is this a problem which can be addressed at the local village level, or are these large infrastructure projects from the top down that have to be deployed through these villages?
It's always a good combination of both, because there's no one size that fits all. And I'm not against centralized systems, but centralized systems take time. Demand investments, very difficult to retrofit, and very difficult to keep pace with the growing population and also the urbanization that we talked about. And therefore, a combination of decentralized that complements centralized. Because if you look at the global population today, there is a section that is on the grid, let's say the water sanitation grid. But there's a large section that is either on a dysfunctional grid, or where the grid is not complete, or where there is no grid at all, right? Now, if you look at the established cities, the London, Paris, New York, Rome, and you know all these cities that have been for there for centuries, their water sanitation systems have been at least 100, 150 years old. They require to be upgraded, renewed, and so on and so forth. And therefore, now the business model is changing for them. But in the parts of the world that we're just referring to, you know, in this part of the world, in Asia, the situation is that the municipal services have a long way to go to catch up. Therefore, relying only on municipal services and utilities is not not going to take us very far. Therefore, the decentralized approach, or at least, if I can touch upon the word, end-to-end management of the water cycle, right? So from source, back to source, and in between, all the sources and uses of the water have to be managed more efficiently. And this can be done better through decentralized applications.
You know, like so many things in Asia, there have been opportunities to leapfrog the West. I think the best, probably single example are you know, wireless networks and mobile phones. There were no fixed line systems in place for throughout most of Asia during the 1970s and 80s. And in comes mobile technology, and overnight you have massive uptake of mobility, which took Asia into a whole different space economically, and allowed them to kind of surpass some of the large infrastructure costs that accompanied Western countries that had to develop these telecommunication systems. Is it a similar situation for water? Is technology actually allowing for opportunities to manage water more efficiently at a lower per unit rate than otherwise major water purification systems of the past?
So certainly there's an economics involved in terms of volume and size. So some things work better on scale, you know, 100 million liters, 200 million liters, and so on and so forth. But what we're realizing that for those plants to run at the optimal efficiency, they need that kind of a load. They need that kind of an intake that comes in, which is very difficult to manage and manipulate. So therefore, what we understand from statistics is that 6 out of 10 plants don't function optimally, and therefore do not deliver the results that they are designed for. On the other hand, the decentralized systems offer tremendous amount of unit economics, especially at rural off-grid scenarios, or where the grid is dysfunctional, or where the grid is overloaded, because you need to at least maintain discharge standards or replenish your own water.
And describe what those units or what these systems look like. Are they standalone purification systems at a central location where people still come to gather the water, or are they piped into people's homes?
Okay. So normally when people talk about or think about water, they think about drinking water first.
Yeah, I do immediately. In fact, I'm thirsty just talking.
But that, Stephen, is only 2 to 3% of the daily water footprint that goes into the system, by the way, drinking or consuming food.
Right.
Okay, a large part of our daily water footprint is for non-potable purposes. Okay, so let me put it into context first before we come into the unit economics. Less than 1% fresh potable water that we have access to supports 7 billion people. We will be 10 billion people soon.
Yeah.
And the total quantum of water is fixed, right? So where's the problem? The problem is that 1% fresh potable water is supporting life systems for us, you and me, for the plant and animal kingdom as well. And those sources are dwindling or getting contaminated at an alarming rate, if you like. So when you look at the cost of water, so it could be for a family, like when I used to wake up at 4 a.m., right? 4 to 6 hours a day, okay? 50% of the diseases are waterborne. So imagine drinking contaminated water and falling sick. The price is, you cannot calculate,
right?
Because health, economics, you know, and everything else. The beast of burden in my lifetime shifted from the boy in the family to the girl in the family, who became responsible along with the mother and everybody else.
Because that right? So at one point it was only everyone pitched in, and now it's just the women.
Now it's just the women. And that transition is unacceptable.
Right.
The reason being that the girl child is then forced to drop out of the education system.
Yeah.
No, for two reasons. Sanitation, because no sanitation, proper sanitation at home, no proper sanitation in school, and then you have this water problem kind of sandwiches her in between. So when she reaches the age of 13, 15, essentially she knocks off the street.
So you're pointing out the fact that water goes well beyond just the need to drink and sustain life. There's socioeconomic impacts that go well beyond anything that people would think about when we just talk about water.
Absolutely. And people don't think about the hidden cost of water, right? So the people talk about pricing and payments and everything else, right? But all that is important. Water has to be priced correctly, no doubt about that.
Right. There's a lot of talk about this now, isn't there?
Yeah. And obviously, because everybody's fighting for the same pool for industry, for agriculture, for domestic habitats, okay? And obviously, we're getting into segments and stratification of, you know, high net worth kind of real estate, for example, which promises 24/7 water supply. Whether they take it from the ground or bring tankers, and it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
So coming to the decentralized, back to the point that you just mentioned, the decentralized standalone distributed systems are excellent when it comes to managing water end to end, because you can take water from the ground, you can take water from a tanker source that's coming in, you can harvest rainwater, right? And of course, treat it to a certain level where you can use it for potable or non-potable purposes, which makes it fit for purpose. But the benefit of decentralized systems is also taking your used water, your sewage, and treating it to a certain quality, which we call fit for purpose, which you can use for gardening, landscaping, car washing, toilet flushing, air conditioning, cooling towers use a lot of water, for example. So if you take a building in front here, 50% of the consumption is for toilet flushing and the rest is for essentially for running the utilities, right? And why should that be using potable water?
Right.
It can be utilizing rainwater, harvested water, and so on and so forth.
So if these technologies are so readily available, what's the issue preventing more of them from being deployed and therefore servicing the interests of local communities?
In my humble experience, especially now sort of neck deep into this, number one is culturally, there is an issue in terms of acceptance, in terms of treated water, recycled water. Many people are not there yet in terms of being able to reuse. The second one, which is very sad, is the perception of plenty. Because when you look at our one blue planet, 70% is water, 30% is land. So everybody thinks we have humongous amount of water, and wherever you drill, you'll find some water, right? But that's not true, because that water is not accessible, not available to us, not at the cost and not at the economics and the distribution network. So from that perspective, the decentralized systems are able to provide fit-for-purpose water. And when you look at the drinking water aspect, they're good. When you look at the recovery of the sewage, they're good. When you look at harvesting and integrating, adding rainwater to the equation, they're good, right? And the thing about technology is now, it's like TVs and many other stuff that used to be very highly priced 20, 25 years ago. It's actually coming down progressively. So what's coming in the way is awareness. Number two is about public health and safety. People are very concerned, you know, what happens if this doesn't work? What happens if something breaks down? You know, what happens if I fall sick and, you know, things happen in terms of contamination or cross-contamination, if you like. The third one has been cost. And people generally, you know, if you talk about establishments, what we are finding is a trend where if there's a strong compliance as a driver, and there's a fine and penalty or incentives involved, people embrace it much faster.
If there are fines with respect to public safety.
Public safety or discharging untreated water, for example, to the network or the local river.
So the issues are more legislative and political. You're saying that the governments and the local, municipal, and even national governments aren't putting the right emphasis on this, and therefore there's not the appropriate incentives in place for people to deploy these units.
Absolutely. And that is something that has to be considered very strongly.
Yeah.
So just bringing down legislations and clamping down and coming hard without giving people an alternative and say this is what you should be doing is very difficult.
You know, Stanley, this is interesting because in some ways you would think there is no greater political necessity than appealing to public safety. And once there is an outbreak, as you say, 50% of diseases are waterborne, you would think that they would create a negative political spiral. So why wouldn't this be one of those obvious subjects for governments to get ahead of? Because it's really addressable, it's cost effective, it suits the needs, political needs of everybody, and obviously health and safety is important.
Sure. The thing, Stephen, it starts and stops at drinking water. It doesn't go beyond drinking water to the untreated sewage and the harvesting and the management of water the way it should be done. Because it's politically right. It makes you popular. And giving more and more free taps and connections and waiving off water bills, it gives you mileage.
So what we need is a more holistic approach to water management that kind of addresses the full cycle and therefore will make sure we have a longer, more sustainable solution.
Absolutely. And that's the only way we can keep our depleting resources kind of alive, preventing them from contamination and pollution. And we do a lot of work in this space. But if you only look at drinking water, then we are driving into the wall, because globally, the gap in demand and supply for water is going to be as high as 40% by 2030. And this is published data, it's not my data.
I'm Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. My guest is Stanley Samuel. More in a moment.
Inside Asia is supported in part by Black Marketing, the world's most recommended LinkedIn marketing agency, created and led by the world's most recommended LinkedIn marketing masterclass instructor, entrepreneur, and best-selling author, Chris J. Reed. Black Marketing is an award-winning, independent, boutique, B2B marketing consultancy that specializes in enabling you to achieve your business objectives through LinkedIn. Learn more at www.blackmarketing.com.
This is Inside Asia, and you're listening to my conversation with Stanley Samuel, founder and CEO of Ecosoft, a hybrid for-profit and not-for-profit water technology and services company based in Singapore. Stanley enjoyed a long and successful career at Nestlé, which perhaps ironically inspired him to think deeply about the long-term implications of water usage. The more he thought about it, the more he felt something had to be done. So he left the corporate world to start a business of his own.
If I come back to the connecting the dots with the journey with water and what I learned at this world's largest food, beverage and wellness company, was a realization about something that I discovered as the virtual water footprint. Okay. So when you ask somebody, how much water do you consume in a day? The answer could be 10 liters or 100 liters or 200 gallons, depending on where you come from, what lifestyle you live. And there's no right or wrong answer. But when I look at our daily activities, right, and how water is kind of built in and woven into those activities, then that's scary. Let me give an example. A loaf of bread that was at the breakfast table this morning is actually 700 liters of water, right?
Yeah.
A glass of juice is about almost 150 to 200 liters of water, right?
Yeah.
A car tire is 7,000 liters of water. A barrel of oil is 12,000 liters of water.
Manufacturing is absolutely overwhelmingly demanding of our water resources.
To add to that, distribution, right? Packaging, if you just take that as an example. So I can go on and on. So when the reality of that virtual water footprint dawned on me through my journey, the corporate journey, because I worked across the value chain and I learned a lot from the best in the business, that is something that made me very restless.
When was that? When did that become apparent to you? I mean, you know, in many corporate jobs, you're focused on either operations or sales or product development. You're not thinking about necessarily the resources. You're thinking about the costs associated with those resources. But was there a moment in your journey when you realized, oh my God, look at the cost of producing X Nestlé product? You know, this is really something that needs thought and consideration. When did that happen?
So this happened at different stages, but the magnitude of it reoccurring was much, I would say, got amplified along the way. So I was working, I worked across, you know, the what we call from the farm to the fork, and had the privilege of working at different functions. But there was a time when I was working at one of the largest manufacturing facilities, you know, as close as possible to the farm.
Yeah. And where was that?
This was in North India. And then, of course, through my work, I was able to travel to other factories as well, other manufacturing locations. And water was an integral part of that entire value chain and quite significant. But of course, a big organization like Nestlé had kind of a commitment and environmental consciousness that it would be very judicious and prudent with how water was managed and how treated water was reused or even met discharge norms, etc., much better than many other organizations.
Always was, or at some point decided we should be in the interest of our industry, in the interest of our resources and available resources?
I think it's a combination of both. Being in the food industry, you cannot think of anything without water, you know, from the very starting of the value chain. So that sensitivity was there. And of course, the rich culture and heritage of being a Swiss multinational with over, at that point in time, was 130 now, I think, 150 years of operating experience. So that was well managed. And I think the organization also spent a lot of time, money, initiative investments in upgrading and putting in new technologies to be able to manage water and, of course, the whole environmental impact. Now, having said that, the privilege of going to distribution centers, the privilege of going to other factories, the privilege of looking at, you know, things at the farm from where everything starts, and to look at consumption on the other side, because when I talked about the virtual water footprint, every time we consume something, we have to wash utensils, and so it doesn't end there, you know. So the shirt that I'm wearing is about 300 liters of water, but every time I put it in the laundry, it's another 3 to 5 liters maybe, right? So there's a life cycle of that, the pattern of production, consumption, production, consumption. And that made me absolutely restless.
restless to the point where you thought maybe it's time for me to move out of corporate and go do something about this, or restless to the degree that you flagged this within Nestlé and participated in helping guide the organization or make suggestions on what might be done to preserve and sustain some of these available water supplies?
So as a part of the large group, we were always part of initiatives that the company would could roll out from time to time. So we played our part there as far as we're concerned. Of course, as key managers, we were also given the opportunity and the platform to share ideas and so on and so forth. So a lot was being done there. But I think there comes a time in one's life where, you know, the where you came from and the roots and the experience and the journey takes over.
It converged.
It converged at one point in time. And for me, if I look at my last assignment, it was great to have people to consume one more extra cup of super premium coffee. But to see a girl child go back to school was even more exciting.
So was that a breaking point for you? Did you say, I've run the gauntlet, I've learned a lot, I'm now going to go and do something about this? And what year was that? When did you make this decision?
So this was way back in 2009, 2010, and still in Singapore, and we set up the Nespresso business from literally scratch here for the region. A great team and a great stint. But the reasons were far too compelling. So I had a choice, either after retirement or before I turn 50.
Right.
So two options, you know. After retirement could be nice, you know, get a pension, live a comfortable life, do something voluntary on the side. But as I said earlier, the more I ran away from water, the more I ran into it as a problem. And therefore, the urge to do something was too strong.
So this was heartfelt at the core of your being. The water that flowed through your blood, you might say, helped put you in a position to say, I will make this decision sooner rather than later. And you were on the cusp of 50?
I was at around 45 that time.
Yeah.
And then what I did was that, very few people do this, is I decided to make an investment in myself. So I pursued a dual degree master's at INSEAD in Singapore and Tsinghua University in Beijing. So I did a 3-year program. And I used that time to transition from corporate to social enterprise that we've just set up.
What were some of the things going through your head at that point? I mean, here you are, a successful corporate leader. You've had this wonderful core. At any point along the way, did you stop and say, whoa, what am I doing? Or once you stepped off, were you convinced that this was the path for you?
So I was not sure initially, but I had to test myself, I had to validate. Yeah. But as I also believe that, you know, the universe conspires in ways, when you look back, that this was inevitable.
Right.
And I could see it coming. So when I joined INSEAD and went to Tsinghua University, everything that I was learning and unlearning on campus was basically pointing me to one direction. Why don't you use this time to see if you can address the water problem? So my entire thesis of almost 18 months was on decentralized and integrated management of water and wastewater.
So you applied the learning. So it's interesting because many people I know go back for mid-career MBAs, are trying to get that big promotion. They want to go up in the food chain in the corporate world. You were thinking about how can I kind of use the learnings from this in order to develop perhaps a new venture, a new way of thinking about water.
Yeah. So what I could do with my dual degree master's in a large corporate was probably limited at that point in time. The impact as well, and I'm not sure how much I would have been able to implement and execute. Right. Having said that, learning is a never-ending process. So I decided, and I was blessed with a good cohort. I got a phenomenal thesis supervisor also by the name of Stephen White, Dr. Stephen White. And they guided me through the process. And that's where I met my co-founder, Marcus Lim, as well, because his thesis was on how to redirect capital into a space like water. And I was doing a thesis on how to manage water better end-to-end.
Serendipity.
Exactly. And we didn't know that we were working on these two projects side by side, because it's in Tsinghua, it's you got to do this project by yourself, not team up and pair up. It's fairly intense. So use that 18 months to kind of walk on fire, if you like. So during that time, I quit my job or couldn't continue, if you like. I went to Gram Vikas in Odisha. I went to the Barefoot College in Rajasthan. I went to Sulabh International in New Delhi, worked with the founders.
To see what they were doing.
What they were doing and whether I'm cut out for this space or not. And you know, what the real problem was, because
you weren't sure. You still weren't sure. Like, I like this idea of water. Conceptually, philosophically, it feels right. But, you know, what does it actually take on the ground?
Absolutely. And can I make the cut? Will I succeed? Do I have a chance to succeed, if you like? And that journey that I took of traveling and going to places where there was a challenge and problem, and somehow I encountered with some of the best brains and minds that were either grappling with the problem or had found a solution. Mm. And things were coming together. And by the time I finished my thesis and the thesis defense, or we graduated, EcoSoft was born. We registered EcoSoft as a social enterprise, and we never looked back.
And when you established that, were you looking to fill a gap in the market, or were you looking to do what others had done well in other places?
Clearly a gap. So we looked at a blue ocean, if you like, if I go back to my marketing days. Clearly, there was a big unmet need out there because you had this centralized, utility-based solutions infrastructure, you know, where 60-70% of the cost is only in the pipelines and networks, right? Just pumping water back and forth. And there was a large part of the world that had a need, but that was unmet. And therefore, we came up with a business model. We came up with a set of solutions that would address that unmet need.
How has that shifted and changed since you launched the company? Have you kind of adapted it based on, you know, hits you? And now I want you to describe the way that you're set up in terms of the profit and nonprofit side of the business. But have you had to make a lot of adjustments, or were you pretty much on the back of the INSEAD thesis, pretty clear about what was needed and how to apply it?
So 18 months was quite sufficient time to go through the whole process and to validate everything. And it's not just a thesis you submit on paper, you actually have to defend it. You got to present it to a panel of almost about 15-20 people and people from the industry as well. But you know what? You have to evolve continuously. But what's important is, if you take a compass, true north has to be true north. It cannot change. So your mission, your vision, and what you set out to do may not change, but the methods, the ways in which you go about doing it, continuously adapt and evolve.
Not to throw a spanner in that work, but you heard magnetic north is moving.
Yeah, it was, I'm told by 50 kilometers every year.
I don't know what that means for us, but I get your point.
Sure. Yeah. So for us, that was important to stay on course very much. But as we did projects, you know, our first project was a rural project because nobody wanted to buy in.
A rural project in India?
In India.
In order to test your theory or just to kind of get started?
No, get started. It was get started upfront, because when we started decentralized and all this stuff, it was basically we were only a PowerPoint. We had no track record. We were a concept note, if you like, and you could see the passion in our eyes, but who would be willing to invest in that? So either we waited to kind of burn out sitting here in Singapore, but we said, let's do something overseas. And that was a good decision.
Because that got you experience, it got you to the market where there was a need, and it also allowed you to then come back and showcase what you were able to do.
Absolutely. So proof of concept, proof of value, prototyping, R&D, solving a problem became in a live environment.
You established yourself as a social enterprise, which has an interesting dynamic. In many ways, you have both profit and nonprofit initiatives. Can you explain how that works?
So the water problem, or let's put it this way, if you're living around a river or water source, the rich and poor are living side by side. You know, industry, agriculture, and commercial activities and domestic habitats have to coexist. And we felt very strongly through our learning journey at INSEAD and Tsinghua University that to solve the water problem, it cannot be only a for-profit approach, and it cannot only be a not-for-profit approach. It has to be a good combination and a good blend of both. Because there are people affected and have the ability to pay, as I mentioned earlier, and there are people affected but don't have the ability to pay. And therefore, we created this crossover, if you like, a 2x2 matrix, you know, urban, rural, for-profit, not-for-profit, technology, education, or awareness, engagement. And that, at that point in time, was heavily criticized because everybody said you could only do one thing at a time. You got to focus. But tell me, we had not much business. We had our own capital. We had this big vision and dream. And we did one thing at a time. Our first project was a rural project. We barely started the rural project. We got a commercial project. Our first demonstration in an engineering college. And from there, we went on. We did some education programs for schools and corporates. So we did it as things came our way, but we were ready.
Do you upfront decide that a percentage of your time and energy will be spent on not-for-profit ventures, or is it just as and when things come through, you assess them on their own merits?
So Marcus and I, who's my co-founder, when we set up this organization, we signed a charter. And in the charter, which is still lying on my altar, 65% of our profits can be redirected from the for-profit to the not-for-profit.
You decided that based on other social enterprise models or just because that felt right to you in establishing the business?
In this part of the world, there were not many social enterprises at that point.
I'm not aware of any, in fact.
2010, 2011.
Yeah.
And therefore, we had done some research. In the UK, there's something called a community interest company, CIC, and they had a framework. So we took that as a model. We, of course, went to certain agencies in Singapore as well, but there was nothing at that point in time. So we took our chance. And we said, this is our commitment. Mm. And we signed it. Literally, we signed it. And we never deviated from that. Now, that 65% can be quantified in terms of time, resources, cash, technology. Mm. It can be cash in kind one way or the other. Mm. And what we found that that approach actually became our competitive strength.
So in other words, those that understood that this is a commitment you had made were more inclined to contract your services because they knew something was going back.
Huge. Even investors.
Even investors. Why would investors say, I'm prepared to take a hit on the potential profit? They're not into feel good. They're into, 10X.
So when we started out, most of the investors that we had were basically what we call family, friends, and fools who believed in the mission.
Yeah.
And they were willing to put in 40, 50, 100K one way or the other, or maybe in two tranches. We started with convertible loans. And we signed in blood, Steve, that we will not take a salary till the company breaks even.
What, this is fascinating because I think in some ways most people would be terrified at the idea of trying to kind of hand over basically on this notion of building a business, giving something back, yet people have bills to pay. How were you able to justify this to your wife?
So partly savings to some extent. A large part of it was also adaptation and sacrifice that one would make, not flying business class, flying economy, staying in guest houses, bed and breakfast kind of places, being very frugal. Mm-hmm. That helped us to go further and longer. The other thing we realized very early on, as I said, we're not that smart. You put in $200,000 as capital, and every month you take back $5,000-$10,000. Basically, there's nothing left after 12 months. Mm-hmm. It's all gone. And where has it gone? Back to your own survival. So it doesn't make sense. So people talk about skin in the game. Here they saw not just skin, they saw us in the game. Mm. And that made a big difference. Mm. That was convincing to a large extent. Mm. The second thing was that when we did our first rural project, we got instant recognition. Mm. It was a blessing.
Because of your structure, because you effectively executed?
Absolutely because of the execution and people could relate it back to the business model. Mm. And we got our commercial project because of the goodwill the rural project created. And later on, this business model became our competitive strength in every possible way that we didn't have to, in parts of the world, no bribery, no corruption, right. Nothing underhand. Right. And because people saw that this is one company that is serious, it's committed, it's on a path and journey. Either I'm a part of this vision or I'm out.
Are there, because of the demand and the need for fresh water and this closed loop approach that you're sharing with us, there must be dozens, hundreds, thousands of providers out there, is this a situation where there's enough for everybody, or is it becoming increasingly competitive to deploy these solutions and deliver on commercial deals?
So the global water market is quite significant. It's almost touching $1 trillion, generally speaking. But as I mentioned to you, we went into places where there was a big gap, and there was literally nobody there active, right? And the only thing that people had was a contaminated source that would basically dry up even in summer. So they would probably have to go another 2-3 kilometers to the next village, if you like, and then fights and so on and so forth, conflict. So when we started, and if I can just spend maybe a few seconds on what we actually delivered for the first village, that'll give you a sense of what we
provided. Yeah, please.
So in this first, what we call a model community based on water, 24/7 access to safe drinking water at every doorstep. 3 taps.
Right to the house.
Right to every single home.
How many homes are we talking about?
We're talking about, at that point in time, the first project was 50 homes. But now it's grown. The village has grown. So there was no government program that even did that. The government program would just have one hand pump for the whole community.
How did you pick that village? Why that one?
So we traveled 52 villages with one of the mentors that I mentioned, Gram Vikas, Dr. Joe Madiyat. And he's been in this business for 40 years. So he came down in December 2012. And we walked literally 52 villages, and we picked the one that was absolutely the base of the base of the base of the pyramid. They were economically kind of rejected. No major government programs or schemes that touched their lives. Basically, all the government programs just passed by their village but never stopped at their village, if you like. They were almost people from the lower caste, and therefore no hope. They were very badly affected.
So you went to base case in order to say, even in the most extreme of situations, we have a solution.
Toughest. Because at the end of the day, it's a community-led transformation program, which means the community has to pay a small amount as token into the corpus. We set up the village executive committee with gender equality on very important principles. 100% inclusion, which means nobody's left out. 100% contribution, which means everybody has to play a part.
Sense of ownership,
very high. Self-governance with gender equality, right? Skill-based training, value-based commitment of not going back to the old ways and protecting what's being built. And more importantly, to take care of their own development going forward. So they literally build the facilities with us, and we build it with them. So from the overhead tank, the drainage sewage network, the used water recovery system, the drinking water supply system is all built with the community.
It's theirs.
It is theirs. And the clincher is every home has a water meter. They pay a volume-based fee. And this volume-based fee goes back into their bank account, into the corpus that keeps the whole program going.
So it wasn't just a technology solution to purify, capture, and deliver water. It was an economic system that was kind of distributed based on supply and demand.
Absolutely. And sustainable. That program is still running, and we won a number of awards, including very recently the Sheikh Zayed Sustainability Prize for doing this transformation with the community.
So was part of the trick here getting everybody to understand what you were doing, not be suspicious of what you were doing, and ultimately sign on and agree to it? Otherwise, this could not have taken place.
Absolutely. The first time when we finally shortlisted this particular community, I mean, who the hell are you? Why should we trust you? You're talking about taking some money up front into corpus. You know, you'll run away. What will we get in return? And for some people, it was like a lottery system. Okay, I'm going to pay, for example, one, and I'm going to get 30 in return because there's so much more that you're talking about, right? So we overcame that. I remember the first meeting, there was only 10 families out of 50 who showed up. And the second meeting, we barely started it. It came down to pour. There was a very strong wind and, you know, the whole meeting went for a toss. But we hung in there and we continued the meeting after the rain stopped. And the end of the meeting, there's just one family says, okay, I will build the first model. So at least these people know what we are talking about. And once that one family said, you know, I will build this first set of toilet and bathing rooms to see and to show what it's like, that gave us a huge boost.
The catalyst.
Mm. And that family, I mean, whenever I go there, I still park my car or vehicle in front of their home. That's the first family agreed.
So from the point of entering the village and saying you've been nominated to the point of completing the system and demonstrating its utility, how long did that take?
So we divided into two phases because it was very tricky in terms of terrain and geography. So we did that whole project in about 15 months, complete end to end. And we handed it over almost 15 months later. But while we were doing that project, almost 23 communities signed up.
Others that wanted the same thing.
Exactly the same thing, because they saw the benefits and it was life-changing.
So when, and then since then, I'm assuming you're tracking and observing and looking at kind of the cost of maintenance and even the economics of the system. How has that gone?
So firstly, the toilet looks as clean and as newly built as they were 5 years ago, number one. Number two, water is still flowing through the taps. Number three, the bank account is still growing. Number four, there's a surplus in the bank account from the savings that they've generated. Number five, more than, I would say, 80% of the girl child in that village now goes to school and college. And many of them are thinking of becoming doctors, lawyers, engineers, lab technicians, you know, salespeople. And that is absolutely, you cannot value that.
Full-blown success.
Full-blown success as far as we're concerned.
Any things that surprised you or didn't happen the way you anticipated?
A few challenges along the way. You know, for example, there will all be people who are a bit politically motivated. There will all be people who will try to manipulate the situation or not wanting to pay or delay some kind of payment and fees or want to modify the design, if you like, because you've tried to standardize the whole thing. essentially a bit of inertia. Why should I build? You know, I've got three members of my family already contributing, like helping you guys out. That other family is only sending one, not realizing that, you know, she's a widow and she has to go and work on the farm and field and then come back in the evening and contribute. So some comparisons, which are quite human in nature, we had to deal with those. The other one was also the fact that, you know, when the women and the girl child is involved, so even though they're exposed to a lot of risks when they go 3, 4, 5 kilometers to fill water, but when you have strangers working and operating in the village, then obviously there's a certain norms that you have to maintain and a distance and respect. So we had learned earlier on, you know, how to cope with those aspects. Other than that, when it came to the transition from completing the project to actually ownership and running it, no problems at all. Because earlier, they had to walk 4 hours, 5 hours to get water. Now they get water at their doorstep.
So are these projects today for your company turn profitable, or are they still in the category of non-profit and you're feeding or funding them from other things you do elsewhere?
So they were non-profit, they will remain non-profit, particularly this example of a rural project. I will also give examples of commercial projects. And we don't intend ever making money.
And you must have just a lineup of villages looking to do something like this. I mean, it's in perpetuity. You could be building these systems forever.
In our lifetime, at least till 2050, we have set certain KPIs. And one of them for this transformation is 10,000 communities.
Yeah.
So I think it's a race with no finishing line.
Yeah.
But what's important, Steve, is that now other people are joining in.
Right.
So we have foundations. Okay. You know, we have corporates that are willing to partner. Mm-hmm. And so, you know what? I'm going to fund 50% of this.
So most enterprises, startups, will go to a market with the highest propensity to purchase, whatever that may be. They demonstrate in typically an urban center, high net worth environment, and they basically go as quickly as they can. You have actually turned that on its head, going to some of the poor, most desperate, most needy of communities, demonstrated technology capability and a business model behind it, and then use that to then leverage yourself into other commercial projects. Give me an example of the first one that fell for you, or a big one that fell for you on the back of this type of work.
So the first project that we did was an engineering college. And this engineering college was looking at becoming sustainable, developing global citizens, and so on and so forth.
Where was this?
This was in central India again, very close to where I was born and raised. But I had lost connection for about 25 years. So when we met the director of this organization, and we just heard him, you know, we asked a few questions, and he's very expressive. He kind of gave a lot of cues and clues that this engineering college has got to be college with a difference. How? He kind of set his agenda. And then we tried to link it back to a business model. You know, he's talking about technologies. He's talking about social impact, environmental impact, awareness, education. So it fitted in beautifully into the four pillars. So there was instant chemistry. And then we invited him and his staff to come and see the work that was happening in the rural community, which was about 15 kilometers away. And they were absolutely, I would say, in awe. And the first thing he said, I would like more of my students to come and participate in this kind of transformation, because this is the future of development. And I would like to see more of these. So it started with internships. And then we started doing some awareness education programs. And then he says, I want to lead by example. And that leading by example meant that we do a project that was low cost, low budget, whatever it is, utilize the strengths on the campus. And within 6 months, we developed the first used water recovery system, which was actually then contaminating the whole river adjoining and the land and so on and so forth. And that became such a huge success that we had more than 500 visitors. And a lot of those visitors became our clients.
And that's the awareness piece. Yes. You know, create something, raise awareness, others go back, proselytize, and off you go.
And then from there, we signed MOUs for becoming eco-friendly campus. Not very far away from that, there's a Xavier's Institute of Development Action Studies. They signed an MOU with us on 4 C's, how to make this campus eco-friendly campus, how to shape careers for the next generation, how to work in the community, if you like, and how to become a center of excellence. So it was nothing to do with technology. it was to do with their vision.
Stanley, you exude confidence, hope, and optimism. So this question may strike you as a little bit odd, but given the challenge that faces us in the world today and all of those villages all across the world that are struggling to figure out a way of managing their water supplies, how hopeful are you? And really, what are we talking about? What needs to be done? What would you advocate for, in other words, in order to make sure that this dream turns into something wonderful for everybody?
From this, I draw inspiration from the starfish story. You know, you must have heard about this man getting up in the morning and throwing the starfish back into the sea before the tide ran out.
And there was that story.
So there was an author who basically was a prolific writer. And one day he was looking for inspiration and he walked on the beach. And from a distance, he saw a man just bending down every time and then picking up something and throwing it in the sea. And as he got nearer, he thought he was dancing or something. He saw that this guy was picking up starfish and throwing them back into the sea. And says, "Young man, what are you doing here?" He says, "Can't you see? I'm picking up starfish and throwing it in the sea." "But why are you doing that?" He says, "Because they will never make it back because the tide is running out." He's saying, "But there are hundreds and thousands of starfish. You know, how are you going to just go on and on, right?" So the man smiled and he bent down again, picked up the next one and threw it back into the sea and said, "It made a difference to that one."
There it is. So this is your role.
This is our role. So we are more facilitators, enablers. We will not be able to solve the water problem all by ourselves. It'll take a generation. And the thing is, we found our purpose. That's exciting. We've been able to find to deliver that purpose. We've been blessed with the opportunities that we got along the way. And our humble goal for 2050, even though I may not be around and Marcus may not be around, is to treat, to manage 1 trillion liters of water every day. To restore, rehabilitate, and protect, conserve 1,000 water bodies, ground, surface, and aquifers. To transform 1 million people into the space of entrepreneurship, because we need a lot of last mile entrepreneurs. And that's our mission in terms of being forward. 10,000 communities and 10 million students around the world as global citizens and ambassadors. That's our vision.
Stanley, Aquaman's got nothing on you. You are the original Aquaman. This is the kind of thing, the superheroic effort that really makes people sit up and pay attention. So, you know, thank you for all your great work and thank you for spending time.
For me, I think when I look back, it's not just me. It's a family that I grew up in. The upbringing that I had, you know, 4 a.m. in the morning. And most importantly, the team, the customers, the associates, and the people that we work with who make the magic happen. We're just playing our part.
That's Stanley Samuel, founder and CEO of Ecosoft, a Singapore-based social enterprise committed to deploying new water conservation technologies and services. This brings us to our Asia Insider Minute, that part of the show where I attempt to sum up what we just heard and pour over a few ideas of my own. Would it be overly dramatic to say water is life? I think not. Consider for a moment that water comprises more than 60% of the human body and inhabits 71% of the Earth's surface. We use it daily for cooking, washing, and waste removal. Every day, countless gallons flow from the ground through our pipes and back out again. Without it, everything stops. But as my guest Stanley Samuel points out, it's not just the life-sustaining quality of water that matters, but rather the issue of access that plays a key role in perpetuating poverty, poor health, and low education. In fact, it's the broader socioeconomic challenges posed by water shortages that spurred Stanley to make the break from corporate life to pursue something greater, a quest to make water cleaner, more available, and more secure for billions. The ripple effects from access to clean water are profound, impacting entire communities and fundamentally altering the odds of everyone living longer, happier, and more flourishing lives. People grow healthier with the elimination of waterborne diseases, which in turn drive down healthcare costs. That increases society's productivity, which builds the capacity for expanding clean water infrastructure to both remote and urban communities. The knock-on effects continue. No longer required to spend hours searching and retrieving fresh water, children, and especially girls, are freed up to attend schools, find jobs, and raise themselves and their families out of poverty. With so much at stake, how we arrive at a more water-conscious society is as important as the why. Stanley puts his faith in technology and the advent of innovation. Corporations, he says, are central actors in this passion play. While capitalist pursuits and profit at all costs delivered some enticing results, the world's problems have moved beyond the things we consume to address how we live, now and in the future. That means altering the underlying business model. The social enterprise approach, he says, creates a new paradigm where for-profit dovetails with non-profit to generate both financial returns and public goodwill. At EcoSoft, the interplay of the two has created a kind of feedback loop, where for-profit deals fund non-profit programs and non-profit programs generate for-profit leads. To get the balance right, market forces alone might not be enough. Government incentives, tax holidays, and feed-in tariffs can help. So can progressive regulatory environments and legal systems. Countries in Asia may have been slow to pick up on some of this, but with communities at risk and political pressure brought to bear, change is at hand. Will this hybrid model a la EcoSoft prevail? It's too early to tell, but as long as commercially savvy and corporate-trained executives like Stanley Samuel enter the field and give it a try, prospects are good. There's a practical way to look at this, but a mythological way as well. Consider the legendary Feng Huang, or Chinese Phoenix, a mystical blend of five creatures representing the Confucian five virtues. The social enterprise model, like the Feng Huang, if well conceived, can yield some magical results. What do you think? Leave us a comment, download the episode, or better yet, reach us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Facebook. We promise to respond responsibly. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.
Inside Asia is supported in part by Black Marketing, the world's most recommended LinkedIn marketing agency, created and led by the world's most recommended LinkedIn marketing masterclass instructor, entrepreneur, and best-selling author, Chris J. Reed. Black Marketing is an award-winning, independent, boutique, B2B marketing consultancy that specializes in enabling you to achieve your business objectives through LinkedIn. Learn more at www.blackmarketing.com.